From the McGrath Institute for Church Life and OSV Podcasts, this is Church Life Today. I'm Leonard DiLorenzo. Special thanks to our episode sponsor, St. Meinrad Arch Abbey and School of Theology, which is inviting us to train our voices for full and active participation in the liturgy. This summer, St. Meinrad will host their biannual chant workshop, July 29th through August 24th, to learn the basics of healthy singing and directing Gregorian chant. Study with expert presenters and join the monks in daily liturgies. But no previous experience is necessary. Find out more at www.stmeinrad.edu/ism. Hi, everybody. So glad that you've made it here for another episode of Church Life Today. You know, believe it or not, we have recently passed our 200th episode of this show. When we started this show back in 2018, we were just kind of exploring this new medium for our work and for engaging in meaningful discussions about things that matter. We didn't know if it would last or if there would be a great deal of interest in it. But now, 5-6 years later, having done 200 episodes, we're just so grateful to you and to others for listening and giving us a chance to dive into things that we're really interested in and that we think matter. One of the things I really love about doing this show is being able to talk to experts about their expertise, to get deep into their work, to go beyond sound bites, and to really think together about these cultural and educational and religious matters that we get into on Church Life Today. But you know, every once in a while, I don't know, every 20, 25 episodes or so, maybe more than that, I do like to kind of keep myself honest by sharing with you some of the work that I have been doing myself. And this episode is going to be one of those. I want to share with you a little bit about a book that I recently published called In Search of a Full Life, A Practical and Spiritual Guide. This book is published by Our Sunday Visitor, who, if you listen to our intros, you would know is also our podcasting partner for Church Life Today. I should say right here at the beginning, I absolutely love working with Our Sunday Visitor on this podcast. I write fairly regularly for their news weekly, and I have now done, what is this, the third book I've done with Our Sunday Visitor. I love publishing the books with them too. The editing is just fantastic. The presentation of their books is really good. Their promotional strategy is excellent. So I'm really happy to partner with Our Sunday Visitor in all these different ways. But this book, In Search of a Full Life, I wanted to share with you some of the content and substance of this book today for our episode. The subtitle, as you heard me just say, is A Practical and Spiritual Guide. My understanding of the Christian life is that the spiritual is always practical, and the practical is the object or the aim of the spiritual. This follows from the very incarnation itself, that the material stuff, our humanity, what goes on in the day-to-day is, in fact, what God has taken on and assumed in Jesus Christ. This little book that I've put together, In Search of a Full Life, A Practical and Spiritual Guide, is really intended to give us a little deeper insight in both of those ways, practically and spiritually, into what mature Christian life really is. Now, if my wife is listening, which let's be honest, she's not. She doesn't need to hear my voice any more than she does. But if she is listening, she's like, are you an expert in Christian maturity? Maybe she would have evidence to the contrary, that I still have many, many, many growing edges. So let me just read you this little bit from the first chapter of this book to let you know what I mean about writing about the mature Christian life. Here's what I say. I believe I know what it means to become a mature and committed Catholic. That does not mean I myself have become the kind of mature and committed Catholic I hope to be. Rather, I have come to understand what a mature and committed Catholic is through my studies, in certain people I have spent time with, and even by the as yet unfulfilled longings in my own practice of the faith. I want to provide you real and meaningful assistance in how to become a mature and committed Catholic. So, let's put this out at the beginning. I am not the full figured Catholic. I am not a fully developed, mature Catholic. And I think you can agree with me on that. But from the benefit and the great grace I've had in the kind of education I've received, some of the studies I've been able to do in people that I have witnessed, as I'm sure you have witnessed, who do really show the magnificence of a full and mature Catholic life, I wanted to put together this book, which each chapter, as you'll hear, has to do with a how to enter into this dimension of becoming a mature and full Catholic, how to enter into this other dimension. I wrote it, I think, in some ways for young people who are looking for bearings, who need a roadmap and guidance and need somebody, lots of people, in fact, but need somebody to be truthful with them, to tell them the things that are true, but in a compassionate and hopefully in an imaginative and vivid manner. But I don't think it's just for young people. I think it's for people like myself, maybe people like some of you who are already well into your adulthood and are maybe looking for new bearings yourself, or you're involved in the business of mentoring, raising, parenting younger people and helping them to enter more fully into the mature Catholic life. What I'm going to do today is I'm going to share with you three of the 20 chapters that are in this book. And as I said just a moment ago, each of the chapters is titled as a how-to. It's not quite like a manual, like do this, then do that. But I titled each chapter how-to because I wanted to definitely keep myself accountable to the practical guidance side of this. While there is, I think, spiritual nourishment and spiritual wisdom, that only really comes home. It only really makes an impact if we find a way for this to become practical in our everyday lives. So let me just read to you the title of the 20 chapters, and then I'm going to pick three of these, read those to you, and that'll be our show for today, which I hope is of interest to you. So here are the 20 chapters. Ready? How to be real. How to listen. How to study and work. How to pray, part one. How to pray, part two. How to pray, part three. How to begin to love your neighbor. How to actually love your neighbor. How to date. How to have sex. How to be Eucharistic, part one. How to be Eucharistic, part two. How to read scripture. How to discern. How to sustain friendships. How to be uncomfortable. How to be mentored. How to mentor, how to grieve, and how to find joy. Now, I'm well aware that one of those titles sticks out more than the others. And unfortunately, I'm sad to say, I'm not going to read that one today. Not because it's salacious and juicy. I just am going to choose some other ones to read today. You know, we're coming up on confirmation season now past Easter, and I had in mind, you know, potential audience for this book would be those who have just been confirmed in the church, who are now charged with growing into the fullness of their discipleship to take responsibility for their faith and to become a source of goodness for others. So maybe this will be a good confirmation present for some of those folks, or as a graduation present, or for other occasions as well. In search of a full life, a practical and spiritual guide from our Sunday visitor. So without any further ado, how about we pick out one of these chapters? And we'll go with that. I'll pick one right from the beginning. This chapter is entitled, How to Listen. Here's how it goes. We are surrounded by so much noise that it is impossible to listen. Seems counterintuitive, doesn't it? We might think that since there is so much to hear, we would be listening all the time. But most of the time, we are listening in the same way that someone who is drowning is drinking. We are taking in so much that rather than refreshing us, the noise is swallowing us up. Your attention is a limited resource, and like every limited resource, it is precious. It is so precious that at every moment of every day, people and companies that you do not know are bidding against each other with actual money to occupy your attention. Look at this. Listen to this. Think about this. Now, quick, over here, now, over there. You know what I'm talking about, right? It's like standing in a room when suddenly voices and other sounds come so quickly from every direction that you spin around to face one, only to hear another right away, and you spin again. Your attention is limited, but the competition for it is so fierce that you often feel overwhelmed. Here's the problem. We are constantly trying to pay attention to so many things that we rarely pay close attention to anything. Think about the phrase pay attention. We pay because attention costs us. But since we are surrounded by so much noise, we actually find ourselves nearly broke. There is little, if anything, in the bank, and our credit is maxed out. We don't have any attention to pay because it has all been spent, or rather, it has been taken from us. That means that whatever or whoever happens to be right in front of us right now receives very little attention. We just don't have any to give. Our attention is spread so widely that there is little left to spend in the here and now. I cannot describe for you exactly what this is like in your life, but I suspect you know the feeling of being stretched and pulled, inundated and overwhelmed by oh so many things. You must know what it is like to glance and glance again at one thing after another as sounds and images scroll by or surround you. I bet you know the strange sensation of being somewhere, but not really being there, because your attention is scattered across so many other places. I suspect you, like me, know what it is like to hear much, but listen little. It is important that we talk about listening here at the outset, because nothing else will matter if we do not learn how to listen. We could talk about prayer and studying, being mentored and being uncomfortable, or even reading scripture and becoming Eucharistic. But if we do not work together on learning how to listen, none of that is likely to go anywhere. Because here is the rock bottom truth. We are submerged in noise. We are not free when that is the case. We cannot be fully human if we are not free. And the mature Catholic life is all about freedom, true freedom. Learning how to listen is about becoming free to give and invest your attention. You are not free to pay attention when your attention is being taken from you by people and groups you barely know who are competing for it. This might sound dramatic, but I am not being dramatic enough. What takes up your attention inevitably influences and shapes you. This is an unalterable fact about us as human beings. What we can decide is who and what has the privilege of influencing and shaping us. That requires developing the discipline and power to guard your attention against the innumerable forces competing for it. Later on, we will think about and learn how to practice giving our attention to those who matter most. Family and friends, those in need, even God. But for now, we want to focus on becoming better stewards of our attention by learning how to listen better. This next section is called simply practicing attention. As I said before, having the right intentions matter, but intention alone is not enough. That before was in the previous chapter, by the way. What we need are small, specific, definite practices that allow our intentions to become incarnate, to become more than ideas or theories. Practices shape who we are. I therefore offer you three specific practices to allow the intention of learning how to listen to slowly take hold in your life. First, take time every single day to remove yourself from noise. Rather than an abstract goal, this must be a firm and definite commitment. Choose 15 minutes at the same time every day and dedicate that time to just being alone, in silence. Write this time in dark, permanent ink on your daily schedule. Make this non-negotiable. Prepare for this time every day by removing the things that would distract you. Lock away your phone. Turn off notifications. Go to a private place. Set a timer so you are not tempted to look at the clock. Then just allow yourself to be present in this time, attentive, but not distracted. What matters is that you do this every day. Later, we will talk about how to unite this particular practice to prayer and to attend to God. But before that, we have to work on reclaiming our power of attention from all the many things that steal it away. Second, set aside one day a week to refrain from being plugged in and working. Because we have the means for always being connected, every day ends up being the same in terms of thinking and worrying about the same things. For one day a week, break the cycle. Ideally, this day will be Sunday, the Christian Sabbath. Plan to spend this day differently. Spend time with the people around you without checking on what's going on with other people in other places. Read. Rest. Cultivate your hobbies. Serve someone who needs help. I am under no illusion here. This is a difficult and costly commitment. In order to dedicate this one day, you will need to be more focused and disciplined the other 6 days of the week, because you will need to accomplish your work during those 6 days in order to free up this one day. So plan accordingly. Third and finally, resist the urge to fill in the in-between times. The in-between times are times like when you were standing in line, or stuck in traffic, or waiting for someone to arrive. What do most of us do in times like these? We grab our phones and quickly scroll or check in or browse around. That might not seem like a big deal, but the cumulative effect of all these little in-between moments is that we become less and less capable of just waiting and being bored. We lose sight of what and who might actually be around us in times like these. We let other things and influences steal our attention in small doses, and we quickly become dependent on or even addicted to that habit. We soon do this without thinking about it. That is not freedom. So the practice for reclaiming the freedom we lose is to willfully resist the urge to fill in the in-between times. No doubt you will fail at this. The important thing is to keep trying. When you realize you gave in without thinking about it during an in-between time, just stop, lightly slap the back of your hand or something like that, and put the phone away. These three practices are simple and direct. They are also demanding. It will be difficult to allow these to become habitual. There is no shortcut here. The only thing to do is make the commitments and then work on keeping them. When you fail, try again. Work on these for a solid month. Then spend some time assessing how your previous month was in terms of holding to these commitments and growing in attention. Are there things you would like to change or do differently? Have these practices improved your life in some way? If so, make the changes you want to make and then renew your commitment to these practices for another month. That is chapter 2, How to Listen, in my book, In Search of a Full Life, a Practical and Spiritual Guide. Special thanks again to our episode sponsor, St. Meinrad Archabbey and School of Theology, inviting us to train our voices for full and active participation in the liturgy. This summer, St. Meinrad will host their biannual chant workshop July 29th through August 24th, learning the basics of healthy singing and directing Gregorian chant. Find out more at www.stmeinrad.edu/ism. All right, so having spent some time with one of the earlier chapters in this book, chapter 2, How to Listen, I thought for the sake of balance, I'd pick one here that's in the middle of the book, and then for the third, we'll pick one at the end of the book. One in the middle of the book that I can pick up that I'm going to read to you now is the chapter on how to date. This is chapter 9. Here we go. I want to talk with you about dating. Maybe you are already married, or for some other reason, you are not interested in dating. But you still might find interest in what I write about here for the sake of supporting friends or thinking about how to raise children who will someday date well. Regardless of your level of personal interest in this topic, I want to start by admitting an obvious but often neglected fact. Dating does not just happen when you want it to. Most people at some time or another want to date someone, whether a specific someone or not. Yet they cannot just make it happen. After all, we are not talking about becoming a pet owner, because you really could get a pet pretty much any time you wanted to. By talking about dating, we are talking about developing a relationship with another human being who, unlike the pet, must be a willing and interested party. There is no store for people whom you could date next to the pet store in the mall. Even if there are apps or other means for matching with another person you might consider dating, none of these means comes with a guarantee. Patience is always a hard virtue to cultivate, but perhaps hardest of all when it comes to the desire to date. Yet patience can foster tenderness and new kinds of openness, which actually form you into an even more loving and compassionate person. Patience itself is preparation for dating, as it is a preparation for marriage and for the religious life. Tenderness and openness are not merely soft characteristics. These are forms of strength. The ability to welcome others into your life and to receive them as they really are. It is also about the ability to allow others to know and receive you as you are. And realizing the fruits of patience as tenderness and openness, among other things, helps us consider what dating is and what it is not. It is not about you getting something. Rather, it is about you freely sharing in something that someone else is also freely sharing in. What you are sharing in together is learning about, enjoying, and willing the good for each other. That is my non-catchy definition of dating: a reciprocal relationship of learning about, enjoying, and willing the good for someone else. Friends, I would never cut it as a producer of The Bachelor, by the way. Personally, I used to put a lot of pressure on every dating relationship I was ever in, beginning as early as short-lived crushes in middle school. Somewhere lurking in my mind was the expectation that for this to be a successful relationship, it had to be more and more intense, and then last forever. Any relationship that did not last forever was a failure. Any relationship that did not get more intense was not progressing. With deep-seated assumptions like that, you are not really dating another person. You are dating a set of expectations and secretly subjecting the other person to those criteria. So we shift into another section here called Four Important Things About Dating, Then Another Thing. Holding things in secret is where the downfall of relationships begin. I think it is fair to say, therefore, that the first important thing when it comes to learning how to date is committing to telling the truth. This is not the same as brute honesty, where you feel compelled to tell the other person every single thing you were thinking or feeling all the time, including whether you think their laugh can be annoying or that they really don't look good in their favorite top. Telling the truth is about keeping things transparent. Respect the other person enough to let them be at peace around you, never giving them a reason to suspect that you are anything less than sincere. And respect yourself enough to mean what you say and say what you mean, rather than merely presenting yourself in one way when, in fact, that is not who you are or what you're about. Telling the truth is as much about being forthcoming about your motivations and intentions as anything else. That means that in order to be honest, you have to avoid constructing little hidden agendas and telling little white lies. Deception sneaks into relationships stealthily and corrodes them from the core. A commitment to truth-telling is absolutely fundamental to a healthy dating relationship, as with any relationship, actually. And so too, therefore, is the humility and courage to ask for forgiveness when you have not been completely honest, and to bestow forgiveness when the other person falls short in that regard too. The exchange of forgiveness is a form of truth-telling. The second important thing in learning how to date is to follow through. There are at least two parts to following through. On the one hand, in order to be a person who regularly follows through, you need to be careful about what you promise. Consider what it takes to fulfill the promise you are making, and consider what it will cost you to see that promise all the way through, come what may. Promising fewer things, but fulfilling more of your promises, is a sign of maturity, responsibility, and respect. On the other hand, to be a person who follows through, you need to, well, actually follow through. Only rarely does follow through come without obstacles. If you make plans for the weekend with the person you are dating, it is probably the case that early on in the relationship, you could not imagine ever wanting to do anything else. But later in the relationship, the excitement will have settled, which makes you less psyched about following through on your word when you hear later about what your other friends are planning for the weekend. Suddenly, you don't want to follow through on your original plans. And here comes a prime occasion for beginning to shy away from transparency. You want to make a little excuse about why you can't do what you said you would do that weekend. What you are not saying is that you actually just want to do something else more. Now, to follow through on what you promised, you would need to sacrifice what you suddenly want to do more in order to honor the plans you made. Or, if necessary and prudent, you should actually talk to your significant other and tell them the real reason you want to change your plans. Be honest. Being upfront and having a dialogue is itself a way of following through. This is the harder path, but it is more responsible and it strengthens trust. The third important thing in learning how to date is that when you are with the other person, be with them. You might think back to what I wrote to you about how to listen and how to work and study. We heard how to listen. We didn't yet hear how to work and study. I pointed out that most of us are so used to splitting our attention among any number of things that we really struggle to be attentive to where we are, what we are doing, and the person or people we are with at any given time. We want to check what's going on elsewhere, and we want to keep soft contact with lots of different folks. What this means in the end is that we become people who are never really present. The fact of the matter is that you cannot learn about, enjoy, or will the good of another person if you are not present to them. In other words, you are not really dating someone if, when you're with them, you habitually split your attention. A key to dating is practicing really being there. Believe me, I do not mean becoming the kind of people who, when they are together, cease to recognize the existence of other human beings or the cosmos in general. Those people are annoying and, in fact, unhealthy. What I do mean is that you have to regularly say no to distractions or competing demands in order to say yes to truly being with the other person. A fourth important thing in learning how to date is to pray for the other person. Bear with me. I am not intending to be lame or unduly pious. I am talking about relocating your own center of concern through prayer. For most of us, most of the time, the center of our concern is ourselves. You have to counter that ingrained tendency by sometimes even forcing yourself to pay attention to the other person's needs and desires. Pay attention when you are together and reflect on them and what is good for them when you are apart. Then pray for them, for their good, not only for your own good that happens to overlap with theirs. In fact, beg God on their behalf. Praying for the other person like this is the most significant way in which we can will their good. The second most significant way to will their good is, after you pray for them, doing whatever you can do to serve them, help them, or support them in whatever way they need. The last thing I will mention as important for learning how to date is to do ordinary things together, even early on. Dating does not always have to be about doing big things together, with everything feeling like a date. In fact, too much of that big date feel contributes to false expectations and, honestly, a lot of play acting. While it is not wise to suggest that your first date be a trip to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles to renew your driver's license, as this will only succeed in showing the other person right away that you are a person without any sense for human interactions, it is not at all a bad idea to do mundane things like that, or maybe things slightly less soul-sucking, as early as the first few weeks of a relationship. Do things where you don't have to dress up, you don't have to be on your best behavior, and you don't have other people waiting on you. This is a way to start to be real with each other earlier, so there isn't some sharp break between the early relationship magical fantasy and the real life into which things eventually settle anyway. Practice being normal, early and often. I have not talked much about romance here. You probably don't want to hear that from me anyway. What I have tried to talk about is how to allow dating to enrich and develop your character. Tell the truth, follow through, pay attention, etc. Even wanting to date and waiting to meet someone is a time to develop patience, to cultivate tenderness and openness. At some point, for some people, there will be a call and then a decision to commit yourself to the other person you have been dating for life through marriage. Should that call and commitment come, you may then continue what you have already started, becoming people of character and generosity together for the good of others. For the majority of relationships that do not move toward marriage, healthy dating relationships, though never perfect, will form both people, in becoming better at learning about, enjoying, and willing the good of another person. So here is the truly last thing that is really perhaps the first thing. To date other people, you have to take a risk. You have to ask someone else on a date. You have to say yes when someone else asks you. One date may be one date. That's fine. Try again and be open. But there is no way to start learning how to date without actually being willing to date. There is always a risk involved because relationships, even short-lived ones, have to do with other human beings who are never just what we expect or exactly what we think we want. Developing relationships with other real people requires us to change and grow. Thank God. Well, that's my little chapter on how to date. That is chapter 9 of In Search of a Full Life, a Practical and Spiritual Guide, published by Our Sunday Visitor. It took me a little longer than I expected to go through those two chapters, but I said I would do three, so let's do a third, if you don't mind. The first one we did, chapter 2, How to Listen. The second one, right from the middle of the book, How to Date, chapter 9. So because, like I said, I'm obsessed with balance, how about we choose one from the end? I'll go to the penultimate chapter, chapter 19. How to Grieve. The very last chapter is chapter 20, How to Find Joy. So I don't want you to think I stop with grief. But I think this is an important topic, how to grieve. So let's read this together. Chapter 19, How to Grieve. The good thing about not caring about something is that you don't care when it's gone. Actually, that's not a good thing at all. Maybe it's convenient and easier not to care. But we are created to care about things and especially about people. The risk of pain in losing who and what we care about is the cost of being the kind of people we are supposed to be. People who care. I think there are really only three kinds of people. Those who have experienced heartbreak, those who have not yet experienced heartbreak, but will, and those who avoid heartbreak at all costs. The first two are separated by circumstance, the last by apathy or stoicism or fear. Of course, we all want to be happy. In fact, we are created and called to unending happiness, but not at the expense of avoiding suffering. Part of our group and development toward becoming fully human is found in learning how to suffer well, which includes learning how to grieve. Grief is the natural human response to losing something or someone we love. Without love, there is no grief. You may already know what I'm talking about, because you have experienced the kind of suffering for which there is no afterward when things go back to normal. That is the kind of suffering where normal itself changes. Or you may not know this personally, and if not, it is really hard to imagine what that might be like. Whether you have or have not suffered in this deep and life-altering way, I think we share a common duty: to prepare to become the kind of people who learn how to bear with loss rather than avoid loss. That sounds unappealing, like a total downer of an idea. Yet the truth is that we are created for more than we often expect or desire for ourselves. We are created for the great joy and privilege of loving and for being the kind of people who can and will bear the cost of love. I have suffered and grieved in my life, but it is entirely possible that you have suffered and grieved more. It goes without saying that I am nowhere near the person who has suffered and grieved the most, so I am no real expert on this stuff from experience. But as I have tried to do throughout this book, I want to draw both from my experience and even more from what I have learned and come to believe to try to tell you the truth about grief. There are four things I want to share with you about how to grieve. First, grieve slowly. So much of our modern lifestyles is about staying on schedule. We pack our days with an ever-increasing number of things to do, things to glance at, and things to worry about. We hate getting behind. We fear being behind, and yet we are constantly behind. We live in environments where progress is everything, where speed and efficiency are revered. We are even encouraged to treat losses in this manner. Deal with them quickly and move on. Don't get bogged down. Don't dwell on things. Don't stop moving. Grief protests against the tyranny of progress. Rushing means not taking things or people seriously. And grief emerges from the recognition that what or who you have lost does indeed matter. If they did not matter, you would not feel sorrow. Letting the pain of grief rest with you is how you honor what or whom you have lost. Practically speaking, grieving slowly requires changes to what and how you live on a day-to-day basis. During a period of grieving, you should intentionally declutter your schedule. You should not submerge yourself under one distraction after another, and you might develop some new practices for how to give yourself the time and space to honor your grief. Journaling, periods of silence throughout the day, a retreat, creating art, talking with a confidant or mentor. Nothing is sadder than a life where nothing matters. Give yourself time to grieve because the people and experiences in your life do, in fact, matter. Second, grieve deeply. Clichés are for the shallows. Everything happens for a reason, distorts the truth, and promises an easy way out for hard things. For those of us who believe in God and entrust Him with our lives, it is true that God abides with us in all things and that He will carry all things to a good end in Him if we will but let Him. But that does not mean that there is a reason for violence or betrayal or cancer or death. God does not respond to such things with an explanation. Here's why this happened. Here's the reason. Instead, God answers with action. God moves near to us in our sorrow and shares in it. The incarnation is nothing if not that. Everything happens for a reason is a distortion of that exceedingly more profound and marvelous truth. God must have wanted another angel in heaven. If that school didn't want you, then they don't deserve you. You're better off without him. There is usually some kernel of truth in responses like these, but that kernel is wrapped in the message to try to let this thing glance off you. Now, of course, we can become paralyzed by grief, when it becomes the only thing in our lives. But trying to let things glance off you rather than letting a loss feel like a loss and feeling the sting of that loss deeply makes us into shallow people. One antidote to the ease of cliches is simply saying, "This sucks. Sorry for the language, but this stinks doesn't just cut it here." Grieving deeply requires saying and allowing yourself to feel that some things do in fact suck. One non-cliched saying that has stuck with me over the years is from Leon Blah, who said this: "There are places in the heart that do not yet exist, and into them enter suffering, that they might exist." I'll read that again. "There are places in the heart that do not yet exist, and into them enter suffering, that they might exist." That's a hard thing to grasp. I think you only grasp it by allowing suffering to enter your heart. Only then do we discover how the suffering and grief that we take to heart strangely, almost miraculously, makes our hearts grow larger. We become more rather than less capable of compassion, and therefore of love. Third part about how to grieve: grieve openly. Grieve openly. I mean this in two senses. The first sense is this: do not grieve in shame or in secret. It is a distinctly and unhealthy modern thing that those who grieve are more or less expected to grieve in private. Public mourning has become taboo. That is nonsense, and it is completely inhumane. That does not mean that we are to make a show or a spectacle of our grief. Instead, it means that we should never feel pressure to keep our grief secret. Share your grief with friends, with coworkers, neighbors, each in a way appropriate to your relationship with them. If you feel that you have to keep your grief private, then I mean this in all seriousness: that is the devil working. The devil always leads us away from the fullness of our humanity. Be human. Grieve openly. The second sense of grieving openly is about doing something with your grief. Open your grief up. I learned about this from, actually, Saint Augustine. Earlier in his life, Augustine had a friend who was very dear to him, whom Augustine says was inseparable from him for over a year. Whatever the 4th century term for besties was, that's what they were. Then that friend died, quite unexpectedly. Augustine says that then, quote, "black grief closed over my heart," unquote. What he means is that his whole world locked up around him. All he did was spend his time seeing and thinking about how his friend was not there and how his own life was now only marked by this loss. Augustine didn't do anything with his grief. He just sat in it and let it consume him. Now that sounds strange coming after what I just said in terms of grieving deeply. It seems like Augustine grieved very deeply, and indeed he did. But grieving deeply does not mean you cannot or should not grieve openly. Augustine shows us this later in his life when his mother, Monica, died. No one was dearer to Augustine than his mother, and he grieved no one's death more deeply than Monica's. The difference by this point in his life, though, after he'd become a Christian, by the way, is that he risked doing something with his grief. First, he prayed about it, offering his pain to God, asking God for God's healing. Second, he prayed for his mother, begging God to forgive her whatever sins she had and to take her into his love. Third and finally, he did what his mother asked him to do before she died. He remembered her at the altar. That is, he offered his pain and his prayers for her with Jesus' offering in the Eucharist. This is not some kind of little religious trick, and it is anything but magic. He did not suddenly feel all better. He continued grieving, but he did something with his grief. He opened it to God and, as a matter of fact, opened it to others in writing about it. His grief was both deep and open. And that brings us to the fourth and final thing I have to say about how to grieve. Number four, grieve communally. Just as there are two sides to grieving openly, there are two sides to grieving communally. First, be open to sharing your grief with others. This can be really hard, a really hard thing to do, but it is absolutely necessary. Yes, this is for your own good, but you know what? It is also for other people's good. In sharing your grief with others, you are doing them a favor. You are giving them the opportunity to become more fully human, to be compassionate, to be who and how they are created to be. One of the greatest obstacles to mercy is the way in which we hide our sufferings from one another. By doing that, we deprive others of the chance to be merciful. Being merciful is the way to be fully human. Sharing your grief with others gives them the chance to be merciful. Not everyone will respond well, and no one will respond perfectly. Still, make it possible for others to join you in your suffering. Especially in those times when you cannot control much else, this is something you can control: sharing your grief with others. The other side of grieving communally is about when other people grieve rather than you. When it comes to other people, you cannot determine whether or not someone else will be afflicted by grief. What you can always decide, though, is whether or not another person grieves alone. Do not let others grieve alone. You can decide to join them in their grief. After all, grief usually feels very lonely. You can choose to pay the cost of loving them. You can bear what is not yours as if it were yours. You can spend time with them, weep with them, listen to them, console them, pray with and for them, offer small sacrifices for them, and even offer big sacrifices for them. You can let their pain affect you. This is not the easy path. It hurts. But it is a pain you choose out of love. It is part of the cost of being fully human. It is a serious but glorious price to pay. Friends, that's chapter 19, How to Grieve, in my little book, In Search of a Full Life, a practical and spiritual guide published by Our Sunday Visitor. I thank you for listening to this. I'm happy to share this with you, and I hope that what you heard today was in some ways enriching or useful to you. Perhaps you think about getting a copy of this book for yourself or for others. Like I said, I think it would be a really meaningful gift for confirmation, for graduation presents, or for a young adult you know, or for somebody that's raising or thinking about young adults, or just for a not so young adult who is interested in digging more deeply into their Christian life. And before we go, I want to offer one last word of thanks to our episode sponsor, St. Meinrad Archabbey and School of Theology, inviting us to train our voices for full and active participation in the liturgy at their biannual chant workshop, July 29th through August 24th, 2024. You will learn the basics of healthy singing and directing Gregorian chant. You can find out more at www.stmeinrad.edu/ISM. Thanks very much, everyone. Talk to you next time.
This has been a production of OSV Podcasts. To learn more, visit osvpodcasts.com.